This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Hello, Olgeta. Welcome to the Slama Language Week for ORFM Dunedin.
Kia ora, everybody. Lim Blong Me, Pete Russell. I work at the University of Otago as an observational oceanographer, and this morning, my presentation, I'm going to talk about Vanuatu and why I think Vanuatu is ground zero for climate change, and I'll give some explanations behind that. So one of the first questions I was asked is why we consider Vanuatu as being ground zero for climate change, and what does ground zero actually mean? So in this context, ground zero means a starting point, or a beginning place, but Vanuatu itself, as you'll see throughout this talk, is right in the firing line for some of these events that I'm going to talk about this morning. So I'm actually giving a presentation here for the radio audience, and just one of the slides I'm showing here, my introductory slide, I've got the Vanuatu flag, I've got a scene of a big coastal slip, another image of a tropical cyclone, and a great picture of our boatmaster we had over there, a gentleman called Watso Tolich, and he drove us around various parts of Malekula, and he's got a t-shirt on that says on the back of it, "Survivor Cyclone Pam." And yeah, that was a very interesting t-shirt that I saw straight away when I got to Vanuatu. So as a observational oceanographer, my job is really boats, instruments, computer, water, and people. And my next slide pretty much shows all the different types of boats that I've worked on, from big seagoing ships to virtually plastic canoes that you tow instruments around with. Probably my main instrument as an observational oceanographer that I use are my eyes. So as an observational oceanographer, about 15 years ago, I got into storm chasing. And when most people think of storm chasing, they think of tearing around the Midwest of the USA in really strange looking vehicles with antennas and the likes, satellite dishes hanging off the top of it. For me, my version of storm chasing is just in a room with a computer and an internet connection. So there's a wealth of information you have out there from various different agencies around the world that put this knowledge up on the internet. So one of them is the Joint Typhoon Warning Center that's based in Hawaii, and that monitors all the storms in our part of the world, so the Pacific, the Western Pacific, and also the Indian Ocean and the Australian region. Another good website is the Japanese Space Agency website, JAXA, and they have instruments in the sky taking photographs of ocean temperature, what we call ocean colour, which is the tiny marine plants in the ocean, which is an area I'm interested in as well. So the next image I'm showing here is of the coast at Kokoda, and you can see the sea here, and you can see the seaward Kokoda mountains, you can see the snow line, there's snow on top of the mountains, and you can also see the bush line at about 1,000 metres. And the reason why I'm showing this photograph is it really just puts into context how thin our atmosphere actually is. So once we start getting up to about 1,000 metres, and we're in temperate latitudes, things stop growing. And once you get to about 1,500 metres, nothing at all grows. It's too cold, and also there's just not the oxygen up there. In comparison, we've got this scene of Kokoda here. We've got the ocean, and the ocean itself has 270 times the mass of the atmosphere. So firstly, our atmosphere is really thin. So whatever changes we're making in the atmosphere, okay, we're not really making change to a large volume. The atmosphere is not this infinite space going all the way out to the edge of the solar system, okay? We don't have a lot of atmosphere. There's a lot more ocean. So the point I'm really trying to make here is The ocean is doing all the heavy lifting when it comes to absorbing all this extra warmth that we've got because we are putting carbon into our atmosphere. So the ocean is 270 times more massive than the atmosphere. Places I've worked in Vanuatu around New Zealand and also down to Scott Base as well. So I've worked from the tropics through to the poles. And while we're talking about Scott Base, the work we did down there, we didn't have a vessel or a boat. We had the sea ice. So you can actually access the ocean underneath the sea ice by drilling holes in the sea ice. And we had a containerized camp down there. So the sea ice, in effect, was our boat that we used to be able to take measurements of what's happening under that sea ice. While we're down in the Antarctic or in the polar regions, I'll just introduce one concept here. When wind blows on water, the very surface layer of water will move in the direction of the wind, but because you're moving a fluid on a spinning planet, this Coriolis effect takes place. So in the southern hemisphere, the fluid wants to move to the left because the planet is spinning, and in the northern hemisphere, the fluid wants to move to the right. So a polar researcher noticed this. He noticed that the wind was blowing in one direction, but all the icebergs were moving at right angles to the wind. So my first concept that I'm introducing here is if you got wind blowing on waters, the net transport of the water is always at right angles to the wind. So in the southern hemisphere, that's to the left, and in the northern hemisphere, that's to the right. Okay, and this has an effect on, or as I'll explain shortly, why Vanuatu ends up being ground zero for climate change. Okay. So if we go to Vanuatu, and this photo I'm showing here for our radio audience is a picture of the beach in Southwest Bay in Mallacoola, and we're looking out to a sunset just below a canopy of lovely tropical trees. So it's the sun itself that provides the power or the force that in turn generates wind, which in turn moves the ocean around. So with Vanuatu, where it's positioned, it's in the tropics, and right on the equator, that is where the sun's heat is the strongest. So as a result of that, because we're heating up the equator with the sun, then air wants to move towards the equator, and on the equator, hot air rises. Okay, that in turn in the tropical regions like Vanuatu, that brings in our trade winds. Okay, because we've got hot air rising on the equator, we've got the southeast trade winds that come in to replace that hot air. And in the northern hemisphere, the same happens with our northeast trade winds coming in. Okay, and this is why we have those trade winds in the tropics. They're a big mover of water. The net effect this has is because water gets transported at right angles to the main wind direction, as we start moving this warm tropical water across the Pacific from the east to the west. And that in turn causes, so for our radio audience, I'm showing an ocean current map, that causes our water to build up in the western part of the Pacific Ocean. So both in the northern hemisphere by the Philippines and in the southern hemisphere around the Solomons, which is just north of Vanuatu. So with this hot water, you can actually look at these various parts of the world where this hot water is moving to. So for our radio audience, I've got a map of the globe, and these hot water destination places I've got circled in red here. And one of them is sort of within the South Pacific Island region. Another one is in the Northern Hemisphere at the Philippine Sea. And then you've also got one over near Central America, that's caused by the equatorial countercurrent. There's one into the Caribbean that's caused by north equatorial currents in the Atlantic. Okay, and then you got some in the Indian Ocean as well. If we have a look at a temperature map, and this is a map of sea surface temperature taken in late January of this year, we can see hot water of 30 degrees or more collecting around the top of Australia and Papua New Guinea and the Solomon. So this is this warm water that the southeast trade winds have pushed across the Pacific. If we have a look at a picture in July last year, you can see similar hot 30 degree water on the equator and north of the equator, particularly in the Philippine area as well. Okay. So this hot water is probably the main reason why Vanuatu ends up in the firing line for tropical cyclones. So we get hot water coming from the east, getting pushed towards the west, towards the Solomons, and that in the end forms cyclones. So for our radio audience, I'm now showing a map of all the cyclone tracks between 1985 and 2005. So we've got 20 years of cyclones, and this is a map of the globe. So tropical cyclones, they exist in the tropics, and you can see these big areas where you've got lots of storm tracks. Okay, so the west, northwest Pacific, around the Philippines, that's a big area. Just west of Mexico in the eastern Pacific, that's another big area. The Atlantic, seaboard of the United States, the Gulf, that's another big area. Southern Indian Ocean, top of Australia, and the southwest Pacific. So these are all the areas with cyclones. What's immediately noticeable is a big strip of no cyclones all the way around the equator. So I talked before about cyclones needing warm water of about 30 degrees at the surface or more. Okay, that's one condition for cyclones. Now, that water's got to be at least 26.5 degrees down at 50 meters in order for that ocean or that upper ocean to have enough heat content to generate a cyclone. Okay, another thing that a cyclone needs is it needs to be at least about 5 degrees away from the equator. And the best way I've got explaining this, I talked about Coriolis before and how fluid moves to the left in the southern hemisphere and to the right in the northern hemisphere. Well, on the equator, for want of a better word, let's just say the cyclone gets confused and doesn't know which way to spin, so it doesn't spin at all. And that's probably the best explanation I have. So you don't get cyclones forming on the equator, even though you're getting all that hot air rising and you've got warm water. Okay. Another condition that we need for cyclones as well is we don't want too much strong wind at upper levels, because that will tend to blow the upper top of the cyclone away while it's trying to form. And so, for example, in the South Atlantic, yes, we do have areas of warm water, but we don't tend to get any cyclones there, and that's because of that wind shear as well. So there are a few conditions that have to be met for cyclones, but probably the main one is this warm water, and this definitely has an effect on Vanuatu's wet weather. Okay. So if we have a look where Vanuatu actually is on the map, Vanuatu extends about 1,300 kilometres in a northeasterly, in a northwesterly direction within the cyclone belt. So the whole of the nation of Vanuatu is within the South Pacific cyclone belt. So not only is Vanuatu located in an area where warm water from across the Pacific builds up over the summer, it also spans 1,300 kilometres of this basin. So the possibility of a cyclone impacting any one of or a number of Vanuatu's islands within a season are quite high. So if we go back to our and this is our image of where all the cyclones formed. These basins where they form actually marries up with where all this hot water is being pushed. Okay. So probably the busiest area for tropical cyclones is what we call the Northwest Pacific Warm Pool, and that's in the Philippine Sea, just east of the Philippines. 60% of our world's tropical cyclones form in this region. The other thing is you can expect a tropical cyclone in this region any time of the year. Okay, so even though there is a season from about July through to about January, July through to about November, you can get storms here 6 months out of season, and Category 5 storms as well. Okay. Probably the second busiest region would be the region just west of Mexico in the Eastern Pacific. Okay. And then the other regions are all much of a muchness. So when I talk about tropical cyclones in Vanuatu, you can't really go past Cyclone Pam. Cyclone Pam was 10 years ago now. It was the most devastating cyclone that hit Vanuatu. It was a Category 5 cyclone, and it formed to the northeast of Vanuatu, around the 10 degree latitude line, and it pretty much went down the Vanuatu Island chain. And this is probably why it was so devastating. It made nearly a direct hit on Efate, where Port Vila is, but it pretty much translated the whole of the island chain. And here I've got a picture of Watso, and he's got his Cyclone Pam shirt on, and it's got the date 13th of March 2015. So Pam was a Category 5 storm, and why it did so much damage, it was the direct hit on a number of islands there. Okay. Here is our different categories of storm. We call them tropical depression, then stop tropical storm to Category 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Different ocean basins have slightly different thresholds for the categories, but yeah, Category 5 storms, pretty strong. What we also have shown on a storm track, and if you go onto Wikipedia and have a look at a storm track, you'll see different coloured dots of where the storm has been. So these different dots are what we call fixes, and these are 6 hourly location statistics of the storm, and the different colours tell you what category of the storm is and where it was. And we can get a lot of useful information from fixes. Okay. So one of the big questions people want to ask about tropical storms is, because we've got climate change, we put this carbon into our atmosphere and we're retaining more heat on the planet because of that, will we get stronger tropical cyclones as a way of dissipating this heat? And probably this publication here, it's called it's done by the author called Cosson. It was released in 2020. It's the first publication that pretty much conclusively tells us that over the last 40 years, storms have got stronger. Now, the thing I like about this paper is these are observations. It's not a computer model, it's not a prediction or forecasting or anything like that. These are real storms, these are real observations. This is what this author, or these authors have observed over the last 40 years. So, in all ocean basins, all 6 of them that we've got here, apart from the North Indian Ocean basin, storms have got stronger within this 40-year period. How they measured the strength is all they did is count the number of Category 3 fixes or greater, and what was that number in comparison to all the other storms they had that year? So a Category 3 storm or greater is what they call a major hurricane. So if you're 3, 4, or 5, you're a major hurricane or a major cyclone. So back in the early 80s, for example, in the North Atlantic, okay, only about 20% of the storms were Category 3 or greater. But if we go forward about 30 years, okay, you're getting up to 50, 40, or 50% of your storms are category 3 or greater. So that's quite a significant increase in strength. Same in the Eastern Pacific, okay. The Western North Pacific, okay, there's been a slight increase here. The South Indian, there's been a major increase there. You've gone from about 20% through to about 40%. South Pacific, okay, about 30% of our storms back in 1980 were category 3. We're up at about 40% now in the last sort of 10 years, a category 3 or greater. So this is reasonably, I would call this pretty conclusive. We've got stronger storms, and it stands to reason if the ocean is slightly warmer, it's going to have more heat content, it's going to have more power for these storms, because a tropical cyclone, it's a devastating event, but it's one of these mechanisms that the planet uses to cool itself, to move water from the tropics and heat from the tropics to the poles. Okay. The other question people would like to ask is, will we get more storms? Okay, well, the first thing I'll say about these tropical cyclones, these are big weather systems. They take up a lot of real estate space on the surface of the earth, so there's limited room for these big weather systems. So we're not going to get hundreds more a month. Okay, but this, I'm showing a particular image here, and we've got, it's in February of 2019, and we've got the cyclone Uma, that I'll talk about a bit later, and it's off the coast of New Caledonia, and you can see the cyclone. But if we go up into the northern hemisphere, there's quite a major cyclone there, just north of Papua New Guinea, west of the Philippines. Okay, so this cyclone here, Wutip, this was a Category 5 storm in February in the northern hemisphere. So this Cat 5 storm is 6 months out of season. So before I said in the Western North Pacific, you can expect a storm any time of the year. Okay. So will we get more storms? The answer is, if our storm season gets extended in the South Pacific, we will get more storms. Okay. Because the longer the season, okay, the more storms you will get. So another thing I'll talk about tropical cyclones that people don't know is they do enhance marine primary productivity. So I personally think they're integral to the tropical marine ecosystem. Okay, so I talked before about when wind blows on water, water gets transported at right angles to the wind. So if we've got a storm spinning clockwise in the southern hemisphere, or the northern, it wouldn't really matter, okay? The water diverges from the where the center of the storm is, so all the water, if the storm sits there and hovers above one spot of the ocean, okay, the water will diverge at the surface, and that will pull up below the eye of the storm quite cold but nutrient-rich water. So this is what can enhance primary production. Because in the tropical ocean, a lot of the nutrients in the surface water have already been used up because you've got a lot of sunlight, okay, and the water's warm, so it traps the deeper water down. The deeper, colder water can't get to the surface unless there's some mechanism to break that thermocline. For example, a coastline and wind blowing around a coastline, that'll uplift this colder water, but also just a cyclone spinning above the ocean, okay, that'll diverge the water at the surface and pull up cold, nutrient-rich water as well. So for our radio listeners, I'm showing an image here of the storm track of Cyclone Geeta, and it started around Vanuatu, went all the way above Fiji, across to Samoa, then down through Tonga, below Fiji and below past New Caledonia, and ended up coming down here to New Zealand. This is back in 2018. But the storm track it left behind this cold water trail of cold water that had pulled up. And in some locations, you can actually see an increase in the phytoplankton. So that's the tiny marine plants that small plankton will use that feed smaller fish and bigger fish and so on. So that's at the very bottom of the food chain. So this storm, Geeta, okay, caused a slight bloom. When I look at different storm tracks, when I see a group of fixes really close together, so we're having a look at a storm track of Cyclone Donna in 2017. So our radio listeners might be able to get that up on Wikipedia. There's quite a cluster of fixes really close together. So that means the storm has stopped and it has hovered in that location for some time. And it looks like it's hovered here for about 2 days. So that immediately attracts me to go and investigate that location. And with Donna here, we find that it pulled up a lot of really cold water. And this is northwest of Santo, one of the main islands. And then when we have a look at the ocean colour, which is the amount of marine plants in the water, we see quite a large phytoplankton bloom as a result once that storm moves off. So if the storm, as it moves off, you might get sunlight on this cold, nutrient-rich water and we get a bloom resulting. And these blooms are huge. So the bloom I'm looking at here for Donna, it's easily the size of all the islands of Vanuatu put together. Okay. We had another one in 2019 called Uma. Okay, that pretty much paused in the same West Vanuatu area, okay, west of Santo, and that was there for about 4 days. Now, Cyclone Uma wasn't a particularly large storm. It became Category 1 for a time, but it did produce a pretty significant phytoplankton bloom west of Vanuatu, and this bloom is huge. And for our radio listeners, I've got a map of New Zealand here in comparison. The size of the bloom is about the size of Otago. So that's a huge amount of primary production this event has produced. What we really don't know is we can see this stuff from space, but we really don't know a lot about it. What happens to this all this production? Does it feed biological marine food chains? Okay. Or does some of this, as we theorise, sink to the bottom and perhaps we might be able to see this primary production as a layer in the sediments and from that hopefully get a heads up on future cyclone activity. So that's one of the areas we're looking at. Okay. So for the radio listeners, I'm showing a map of where all these blooms are, and there's west of Vanuatu, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, there's about 7, there's about another 4 just east, but they tend to be clustered around Vanuatu. So these are areas where a cyclone will stop, it'll hover, and it will suck up cold water. But it's really a statement to say this is where a lot of tropical cyclones are forming, okay, in this West Vanuatu region. Okay. One of the other climate issues happening within Vanuatu, and it can be associated with tropical cyclones, and that's just high rainfall. So when I visited Malekula, one of the village elders there was talking about the amount of sediment that ends up in the coastal water. And I sort of asked him about cyclones. And he said, well, yeah, we've had a few, but he mainly pointed to just the sheer amount of increased rainfall they've had in the last decade. And again, it stands to reason, if you've got slightly warmer oceans, then the carrying capacity of the atmosphere above those oceans for water increases as well. So if the atmosphere gets slightly warmer, it can hold slightly more moisture. So when these weather systems end up releasing their moisture as rainfall, they're carrying a little bit more. So that's behind what's in this increased rainfall. But the main problem, and we've got this problem here in New Zealand as well, and it is throughout other Pacific islands, is sediment ends up in the rivers and waterways and ends up on the coastline. And for us back home here, it means kelp doesn't grow as deep. Our kelp is like our rainforest. It's a nursery habitat. For the tropics, okay, this has an effect on coral reef systems and sediment. A lot of these coral plants and animals and the likes, they filter sediment-laden water, so they've got to work extra hard to get their daily food because they're having to filter all the sediment in the water as well. Okay, so when I dived the reef in Vanuatu, okay, the inner reef, you know, there was a certain amount of degrading of the inner reef because of this increased sediment loading, but the outer reef itself was quite healthy because it gets well flushed by the swell. Okay, I've got a few images here for our radio audience that shows the inner reef. You've still got fish there, you've still got coral, but not to the same extent you might see on the outer reef. Okay, but communities within Vanuatu, and these are part of Vanuatu's community conservation areas, have begun, or have been for quite some time, restoring a lot of their coral reef systems. So they've got an activity they call reef gardening over there. And in this particular village I visited called Lembenwin in Southwest Bay in Mullacoola, they have got a lagoon behind them, the Siri Lagoon, which is a major nursery habitat for their reef fishes. So they've got restoration work happening within the lagoon, but also on the reef out in front. And I got to meet this gentleman here, Carly Jacobus, former Pacific boxing champion. He's one of the fisheries people behind driving this conservation effort in Southwest Bay. So Carly and his team, they actually grow out coral in a coral nursery to be able to, similar to our plant nurseries we have here in New Zealand, to give coral to other communities that they can use to help restore some of their reefs as well. So that's another thing that's been happening in Vanuatu. So that pretty much brings me to the end of the talk. One thing I did notice when I was in Vanuatu, I arrived in Vanuatu a week after the two cyclones, Kevin and Judy, and they impacted the islands within 2 days of each other. I was surprised about how quickly Vanuatu gets back on its feet. I'm not dismissing the damage that happens there, but Vanuatu gets a lot of cyclones and people, I'm not saying anybody can get used to this, but people there know what to do. I've got this wonderful picture here of a couple of gentlemen. They're repairing a wall on a house, and the repairs are made out of bamboo. So they're building this bamboo wall. So a lot of people within these communities don't have access to building materials, so they're using the natural materials. And when it comes to tropical cyclones, some of these materials are easily sourced, and so it's quite easy for some of these communities to get back on their feet after a tropical cyclone. So that pretty much brings me to the end of my talk. I would like to acknowledge the people of Southwest Bay and Mullacoola, Vanuatu. Terry Kupper, who was the elder who showed us around, Watso Tolish, our boat driver, Rabong Saro, Kaindun Rum and Isanaki, Carly Jacobus, John Sawyer in the South Best Bay Presbyterian College, June Brian Molotaviti from Vanuatu Fisheries, and Lena Isno, and my collaborators, Dr. Chris Horvitt from the Brown University and the University of Auckland, and Rosalie Richards, the Director of Coast of People's Southern Skies. So kia ora everybody. I know that's a lot in one hit about why Vanuatu is ground zero, but it's all to do with warm water. Yeah, kia ora.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.